And welcome back. When author journalist Alan Weissman was last on this program, he was talking about his best-selling book, The World Without Us. It posed the question, how and how long would it take planet Earth to rid itself of any evidence that we had ever been here? And how much did we improve the planet during our time, and how much did we damage it? Now his question is, how can the planet survive with us, specifically with regard to its ability to sustain the rapidly increasing number of us? It's posed in his new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. It's a pleasure to welcome Alan Weissman in the studio once again. Nice to see you.
Thanks. Nice to be back in St. Louis.
Countdown has certainly an ominous sound to it, an ominous ring to it in your title.
Well, it's double entendre plays here. The ominous part is that we might be counting down to some kind of a detonation, but the other is perhaps we could count ourselves down to a sustainable balance with the rest of nature.
The rest of nature, but it's our population that seems to be the problem at the present time.
You know, that's what I ran into at the end of my book, The World Without Us, which I really wrote because I wanted a world with us. I wanted to remove us theoretically from the landscape. Everyone sees how beautifully nature could rebound without the constant pressures that we heap on it. And then I hoped, wonder, isn't there a way to add ourselves back into the picture of this newly restored Earth? But then I discovered that every 4 to 4.5 days we were adding a million people to the planet, and this is clearly not a sustainable figure. It's an explosive topic. The idea of population control has its own ominous rings, and yet many readers were fascinated and concerned about this. And finally, I decided to look at it dispassionately, as journalists are supposed to do, and try to understand how many people can fit on this planet without tipping it over, and is there something that we can do about it that's not so onerous as China's notorious one-child policy?
Well, you point out in the book that we're headed for a worldwide population of about 10 billion in the year 2100.
Actually, the 10.9 billion.
Yeah. What's a billion here or there, right?
Yeah. As Ev Dirksen used to say, billion here and there, soon, right. Pretty soon we're talking about real money.
Well, let's talk about what the problem of this burgeoning population is. What is it creating that creates these ominous overtones for us?
Well, the number of people on the planet has now to the point that we are part of the most abnormal population spurt in the history of biology, aside from a few microbial blooms out there. No other species has done what we have done. In nature, every species creates a lot of copies of itself because infant mortality is very high. And in the history of the human race, most babies didn't make it to their fifth birthday. Our great-great-great-grandmothers would have 7 or 8 kids, but if they were fortunate, a couple of them would survive. With 2 people surviving, population stays the same because it's 2 people having 2 kids, replacing themselves. Anything over that population grows and didn't really start growing until we got very adept at medical technology, starting with a cure for smallpox and then adding all kinds of other wonderful things that we did in the 19th century, pasteurization of milk, etc. Suddenly, fewer babies were dying, people were living longer, and our population went over a billion, and then it went over a half a billion. But in the 20th century, the population shot up in a way that is extraordinary. The curve that was a gently sloping line suddenly went vertical. And that's because we discovered ways to grow more food on this planet than nature ever could through chemical fertilizers and then through some adept crossbreeding of crops, the Green Revolution, that allowed us to get a lot more grain per stalk. But that's had some unintended consequences, and now there are so many of us who are eating well enough to produce so many more of us and not die of famines, etc., that we are placing so much pressure on the planet that things kind of bursting. I mean, we've packed so much of our exhaust into the atmosphere that we've changed the very weather and the chemistry of the seas, and we're doing – we're literally pushing a lot of other species off the edge of the earth.
The pressure to produce food, of course, is enormous. I was looking at a line here from your book. At one point you say, we are currently using all of the cropland that we will ever have.
Well, we have cleared away an enormous amount of forest or other habitats that used to be the home to many other species. You know, here in the heartland, this used to be a very biodiverse prairie. Now you walk outside of the city and all you start seeing are cornfields and soybeans that are not only monospecific, one species, but they're one hybrid variety, which makes them very susceptible to diseases. We now know that we can't cut any more forests. We lose their water retention. We lose their oxygen recycling. But as scientists at the Green Revolution Center told me, that in the next 50 years, we have to produce more food than has been consumed in all of human history to keep up with population growth, and they honestly don't think we're going to do it.
But with the genetic modification that is becoming so prevalent these days, will that offset some of the negatives here?
A lot of people would like to think so. They'd like to think that human ingenuity can solve any problem. In fact, you know, one of the places – I go to 21 countries right. in this book, and one of them was Vatican City for obvious reasons. But one thing that that interested me when I went there is that Pope Benedict – this is just before he retired, had said that there's enough food on the planet for everyone if we share equitably. Well, one thing I wanted to know is when Holy Father was talking about everyone, did he mean just Homo sapiens, or was he talking about all these other species too? Because God makes it pretty clear to Noah that we have to have – we have to save the animals in order to save ourselves. Well, turns out that biodiversity wasn't high on the radar there, but he told me in the Green – or not the Pope himself, but the head of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences told me that in the centers of the Green Revolution, they're coming up with a new transgenic that is going to solve all this, and that is a way of kicking up photosynthesis, more than doubling it to, you know, make plants better solar collectors. Trouble is – I'd already been to those centers, and they showed me those experiments where they said, this is all 20 to 30 years off if we can even do it, and we don't even know. And by then, there's going to be, at present growth rates, 2.5 billion more people on the planet, and we are worried.
You said you went to the Vatican for obvious reasons. What are those obvious reasons?
Well, a lot of people ask me if religion is a major factor in emphasizing population growth, encouraging it. In all those 21 countries, I interview religious leaders everywhere to see if there's anything in the history or the liturgies of those religions that might, as it says in Ecclesiastes, encourage us to refrain from embracing at times. There's an example in my book how after three generations of polygamists, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Joseph, who's very observant, holds himself to one wife and two children because he realizes we're entering a time of scarcity, and that's what he advises the Pharaoh. Well, in the case of the Catholic Church, they obviously still encourage population growth. The Catholic Church used to be this middle-sized European country until a nationalist uprising deprived it of all of its land, and suddenly it only has 110 acres. And you're not very powerful at that point. So the Pope, it was Pius IX, had to invent something fast, and he came up with a concept that really didn't exist till around the 1860s, papal infallibility. And then they wanted a lot of Catholics, strength through numbers, even if they were outside the walls of the Vatican City. So they were been opposed to birth control all these years. But now, even though the Pontifical Academy of Sciences itself has said that it's absolutely absurd to have families of more than two kids per children, given the pressure on resources here, they're painted into a corner. If the current pope were to say, okay, we're going to legalize contraception, that means that, oh, the church has been mistaken all the years in condemning people as sinners for using it. And the Protestants were right. They can't do that.
And a large portion of the world's population, of course, is Catholic.
Well, you know, Vatican City is surrounded by a Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest birth rates on this planet because Italy is a great example of something that I found in all my travels. Rich country, poor country. The best contraception of all is female education, because a girl who studies defers her childbearing while she's studying almost always. And then once she's out, she's got something interesting and useful to do with her life, something that could be economically very helpful to her family, because she probably wants to be a mother. But you can't exercise a profession or even hold on a job easily if you've got seven kids. So the average throughout the world for a woman who gets past secondary school is two children or fewer. And if we could push education for females throughout the world, we wouldn't have nearly the environmental pressure from our population.
And of course, we're reading today every day about how this is being resisted, education for young girls in various parts of the world, and involving a lot of people.
Well, you know, I've got a pretty scary chapter in this book that's set in Pakistan, because Pakistan was one of the recipient of the Green Revolution. It didn't fall into famine, so people who would have died lived to beget more children, and now it's got 190 million people, and they are they're just overwhelming that country. They can't employ everybody, so you got all these frustrated, angry young men who become terrorists, etc. But I went to a school in Pakistan. That was started by some businessmen who just got fed up with how their country was going down the tubes. And they decided they were going to start their own school system in the poorest parts of Pakistan. 50% girls and boys needed female teachers, so people would send their girls there. And this school was really beautiful and wonderful. It was in a very conservative area. They couldn't talk about family planning, but they fix up every girl with a mentor in whatever profession the girl says someday she would like to be. And these girls want to be nurses or doctors or flight attendants or whatever. And they see that these people only have two kids. So that's how they're spreading it. So I asked one of the founders, I said, yeah, but what do you do about the Taliban? He said, we just told the Taliban right off. You want to blow up one of our schools because we're educating girls? For everyone you blow up, we're going to open five more. They just opened their 1,000th school in Pakistan. So this is a way to do it.
Yeah, we don't hear much about that, do we? You have another scary story in the book, and that concerns the passenger pigeon, extinct now, of course. But you say the passenger pigeon was extinct when there were still a million left. They were kind of the dead pigeon walking, if you will, I think is one of the ways you put it.
Yeah, you know, the passenger pigeon, and I tell that story in my last book, The World Without Us. It was once the most abundant bird on the planet. You know, a flock of them would darken the skies for hours. But then we started mowing down their habitat in the United States, which were trees that they roosted in. And it got to be the point that we had cut down so much habitat that there was still this, you know, population explosion of them. But at the point that it was a million, scientists already realized that they were not going to be able to survive. And, of course, the question is, it's a symbol in this book. Are we already at that point that we have altered our landscape, our the habitat that allowed us to evolve, including all those other species that we co-evolved with whose presence does indispensable things for the human race? Have we already pushed it beyond the point of no return? I certainly hope that we haven't. We all know now that the Antarctic ice sheet is starting to break up and that a couple centuries from now, our coastlines are going to look very different. Two-thirds of our population lives within a couple hundred kilometers of coastlines, and most of our major economic centers are on coasts. So this ought to give us something to think about.
There are a lot of dots that are being connected in our world today. We had Mackenzie Funk on the program. I don't know if you know who he is. He's written a book called Windfall, showing how people are profiting from all of this. And, of course, Tom Friedman's book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, I guess it is, has also made these points, as in Al Gore and many, many, many others. You indicate that you may feel that we are very close to that point of the passenger pigeon. You really think so?
I don't know. You know, none of us knows. I mean, one of the questions, I boiled down this book to four questions. How many people can fit on the planet? How much nature do we need to preserve to guarantee our own survival? One that I mentioned before, is there something in the wide swath of the Earth's cultures that could accept this idea of having fewer people in a time of need, which is why I went to so many countries. And the last one, huge question, is how do we design an economy if we have to shrink our population to come down to a sustainable site? How do we design an economy that isn't based on constant growth, that can prosper? Well, that second question, how much nature, is the one that we really can't answer for sure until it's too late. It's just simply Russian roulette to keep pushing species off the planet and hoping that, okay, well, we've gotten along without the passenger pigeon, so maybe it's okay. But no, at a certain point, something indispensable is going to go.
Well, let's talk about some numbers. I hate to do this generally, but we're talking about 10.9 billion people by the year 2100. What is a sustainable number, do you think?
It's quite likely fewer than even what we're at right now, 7.2 billion. There are two calculations in this book about that number. One of them has to do with how much carbon dioxide can the atmosphere sustain without destabilizing. And, you know, we now have more CO2 because so many of us demand energy. There's more CO2 up there than there has been in 3 million years, and the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher then. The other one, though, has to do with food. We now occupy, just for our own food production, 40% of the non-frozen earth. It doesn't leave a lot of room for other species. But to understand how we got to that point, we now force feed our food with chemistry. We're eating oil. 40% of us would not be here without nitrogen fertilizer. But the downsides of nitrogen fertilizer are huge. It strips soil of its nutrients. It fouls our rivers, screws up our fish, and leaves dead zones the size of New Jersey at the mouth of the world's great rivers. Plus, the plants that we eat are developed in laboratories to be much more prolific, but they didn't evolve in nature with natural defenses, so we have to protect them artificially with chemistry that we are deluding ourselves to believe that these poisons only poison organisms we don't like but don't impact ones that we do, including ourselves. Before chemistry took over the food supply, there were about 2 billion people on Earth. And that's pretty much the same figure, between 1.5 to 2 billion or so, that could be consuming carbon dioxide and live at a level that we would like to live, at least a European level of existence. So that, coincidentally, was the population just only in 1930. We were a pretty developed society by then. If everyone had two children, and some people had fewer, but no more than two, over the next two generations or so, we would start bringing ourselves down to a natural population decline that would give us time for our economy to adjust. And there's a whole chapter we're not going to have time to get into about how that would work. We could do just fine. We could bring ourselves into balance with the rest of nature. And it's the fastest thing that I know of that we could do to lessen our contribution of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere.
And just one point about nitrogen. On NPR this morning, they were talking about why they grow beans in Italy. And that's because beans take the nitrogen out of the air and put it in the earth in a way that is not harmful to anybody.
The amount of plant life on this planet up until World War I, when we invented artificial nitrogen fertilizer, the Germans invented it, was limited to the contribution of that essential nutrient, nitrogen, limited to a relatively few species of plants that host nitrogen-fixing bacteria at their roots, and beans and legumes are among them. So if we go back to the natural way, we won't be poisoning ourselves, and we can gradually phase out nitrogen so we're not, you know, using famine to cut our population. I want everybody alive to have a good, long, healthy lifestyle, but we could gradually be bringing fewer people into the world to replace ourselves.
You were in various parts of the world and doing research for this book. And if decreasing the size of our population, as you just indicated, to bringing it down to below where we are right now, that would require an awful lot of effort in the third world where populations are burgeoning. How do you pull that off?
Well, I've got several examples in Countdown, countries that I went to that without an onerous population control situation like China's, that they have brought themselves down below replacement rates simply by making it very attractive to people to have fewer babies. I mean, Mexico did it through soap operas of all things. They showed people these examples in these soap operas. You know, here's the family who's small. It's doing a lot better than the family that's way overgrown. And there's an episode where the wife is complaining. She's had so many babies. She wants to take birth control pills. The macho father says, no, not in my house. But then a few episodes later, he sees the light. And you watch the listenership or the viewership of this series of soap operas increase over 10 years as the fertility rate in Mexico drops 34%. It's a perfect intersection. And there are many examples in my book. Thailand's another one that's now below replacement rate. An economist realized that we just can't possibly keep developing if our cities are overrun by all these hordes of kids. And it's now got they're below replacement rate, and they got the best economy in South Asia.
What other kinds of pressures is this overpopulation placing on all of us? You mentioned Pakistan before and some of the pressures there with regard to terrorists, for instance.
Sure.
I mean, is this something that we can look to, perhaps becoming an even greater concern than it is now?
In 1958, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was then the president, asked one of his allied generals, William Draper, to look at population because nitrogen fertilizer had pushed us beyond 2 billion. We were almost at 3 billion. Draper spent the rest of his life preaching population. Eisenhower announced that in the rest of the 20th century, the biggest single threat to global security was going to be overpopulation. Well, we're beyond the 20th century right now, and our population is still soaring. Just think of how more peaceful this world would be with fewer people in it. Virtually every one of our problems, and certainly all our environmental problems, could be traced to the fact that there's just so many of us. Even if we had clean zero-emission energy, you know what the traffic is like. You know what happened to those places you used to love that you could get to so easily, and now they're just buried below condominia or strip malls.
Well, Mackenzie Funk in his book said, as oceans rise and people who live, you know, on the edge of wherever they happen to live, the edge of the oceans, they're going to have to move someplace, and this is going to put tremendous pressure on the countries and their own countries and countries around them, because they're going to be literally refugees from climate change.
And think of this, too. These highly refined grains that we have right now, Green Revolution, they're at their threshold of temperature. And for every 1 degree average rise, 1 degree centigrade average rise, crops, harvests are expected to drop by 10%. Think of all the rice, the world's most important food that's grown at sea level. What are we going to do? Put a dike in front of all of Asia and around all the Philippine Islands?
That's some dike. Someday. Let's take a quick call as time allows. Charles in Chesterfield. We're running out of time, Charles, but make your question or comment quickly, please.
Howdy. Line you might like and an idea you might use. The idea is if we use genetic engineering to make ourselves smaller, the entire universe would become larger. The line you might like is our species is garbaging life zone Earth from above the top of the sky, as in space garbage, to below the bottoms of the oceans, as in BP, below petroleum, and everything in between, which is brain waves and genetics. Thank you.
Well, I don't disagree that we are following our nest big time. In terms of genetically modifying ourselves to be smaller people, very interesting. Probably isn't going to happen. I mean, you know, the two big drivers of population, as I mentioned before, were medical improvements and an artificially chemically force-fed food supply. It's very hard to get anybody, myself included, to accept the idea of tinkering with our bodies or with withholding from ourselves medical advances. But force feeding ourselves with chemistry is ultimately just poisoning ourselves. And one way or another, our population is going to come down. Nature does not let any organism exist for very long at the limits of – beyond its limits before there's a population crash. We have the ability to manage ours gracefully rather than let nature do it to us, and that's what I hope we do.
Only a few seconds left. In your travels in various parts of the world, what sort of a response were you getting to your message for people that you spoke to?
Well, you know, it's not my message. I'm a journalist. I just ask questions. But I found that people were very grateful to be talking about this because everybody, even the poorest people, sensed it. You know, the scientists from the Green Revolution thanked me because their founder, Norman Borlaug, when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for saving more people on Earth than anyone in human history, he didn't gloat over that. He said unless food production enhancement and population control join forces together, we're going to have a terrible problem in the future. Well, it's the future, folks.
And it's an important message, obviously, and so well laid out in your book. The book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. By the way, Alan Weissman will be appearing tonight at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh. That's just south of Highway 40. He'll be in the auditorium there to discuss his book. And I'm told, and I'm sure you realize, having listened to Mr. Weissman, that a good crowd will be there tonight. A good crowd is expected. So if you'd like to hear more of what he has to say, get there early. Good advice. Alan Weissman, so nice to see you again. Congratulations on the book. I can't wait to finish it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with our panel of legal experts. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.